Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
In the movie industry, there's clarity around who the customer is. There's just absolute clarity. Who am I here to delight? Who am I here to influence? Who is that customer, right? And we forget who our customer. If you're designing a hospital, who is the customer?
It's going to be the person in the bed.
Right. And that's really what the owner needs help with. And for some reason, we get, you know, if you ask the contractor, ask the drywall person, right? Who's your customer? The contractor. No, it's the patient. Like, we're all working in a way to serve the customer, which may not be transactionally our term. Maybe it's more the user. And we all have to be aligned on what we think that user experience will be like today, tomorrow, and the next day, and how we want to craft and shape that user experience.
Welcome to Context and Clarity, the place where authors, experts, and thought leaders come to have engaged conversations with entrepreneurial architects just like you. I'm Jeff Eccles, and every Thursday afternoon on Context and Clarity Live, Catherine McPhail and I, and our live audiences that are joining us from all across the internet, we have a conversation with a special guest to search for clarity around the things that matter most to you, the architect, no matter what your context is. In this episode, we talk with KP Reddy, serial entrepreneur, AEC thought leader, and the founder and CEO of Shadow Ventures. Our guest today is a serial entrepreneur, an investor, and a founder. He's an AEC thought leader, a coach, and a mentor. He's the author of What You Know About Startups Is Wrong, How to Navigate Entrepreneurial Urban Legends That Threaten Your Relationships, Your Health, Your Finances, and Your Career. And he's the founder and CEO of Shadow Ventures, a venture capital firm that's investing in seed stage startups, innovating the built environment. KP Reddy, welcome to Context and Clarity Live.
Hey there, how are y'all?
Doing really well. Doing really well. Thank you for joining us today. I'm really looking forward to this. We'll probably get into a project that I do with my grad students, and I think how it relates to what you do. But before we go there, I wanted to say, and since Mark R. LePage's comment is the last one up on the screen at this point, I really enjoyed listening to you and Mark talk when you were on the Entree Architect podcast with him. And one of the things that you said in that interview, in that conversation, was that we're the last industry that's creating a product that shapes the future of humanity. And then you said, and we're not really treated generally that well for it. So maybe that's a jumping off point.
Yeah.
Maybe it means that there's a lot of things that need to change. But when you talk about that, and I think you're exactly right. You know, hey, the things, whether it's roads or buildings or, you know, whatever the things are, they are truly shaping human experience. When you said that, what were you feeling? You know, it sounds like there's some frustration, which I think a lot of this audience shares, but what are you feeling in relation to that I call it a disconnect between, hey, this is what we're doing, and hey, this is how we're being treated.
Yeah. No, and I think there's a second part of that too, is that we design and build things with massive permanency.
Yeah.
Right. Great. You designed the iPhone 4 and a year, iPhone 5, there's not a lot of products that have to be designed with what does it look like in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years.
Right.
There's very few industries that have to think about that. And they get to make up their mistakes in the next version, right? They get to add features to the next version, whereas we have to have a little bit of premonition around what that feature may be needed 5 years from now, 10 years. So I think that the challenge is real, but part of my feelings around that is kind of why I do what I do. I'm a second generation civil engineer, grew up in engineering, started writing code when I was a kid, but I didn't see a path staying as a civil engineer to really make a difference. And so I took a different path. I took the entrepreneurial path and got into tech. And, you know, it's so far, I kind of came out of retirement to start this firm with, you know, with this mission in mind, right? This mission.
Well, I love that. And we see that. And that's one of the things that I think I value when I'm teaching. Generally, I've been teaching graduate students, but I did teach an undergrad section last semester. And to me, that brings, being around those students brings a lot of enthusiasm, because the students these days are looking at things differently, I think, than we did back when we were in school. They're not necessarily tied to what other guests have referred to as the noun problem. Oh, I'm an architect, so I have to design buildings, right? Mm-hmm. This is that direct association there. So when you think about the future of the industry, maybe even the future of Shadow Ventures, what do you see looking forward? Where do you think this is headed, and how much influence can Shadow Ventures have on it?
So I think one of the things, you know, we've talked for years about kind of collaboration and community and all that. And it's an interesting dynamic in our space that while we've talked about it, we talk about interdisciplinary approaches, we talk about all these words, yet we haven't executed on any of it. And we create an academic system that puts everybody in silos. Like I help out at Georgia Tech every once in a while, and it's like the building construction department and the architect, they're all separate. They do their senior design projects separately, and then we throw them in the workforce and we tell them collaboration.
Yeah.
Right. So I think the future is truly blurring some of the lines in order to create collaboration. So I think that, you know, and I think our role in this, you know, we're super fortunate. You know, we're backed by almost 200 firms and, you know, design firms, construction companies, real estate developers that back us. And then our broader community of even more that are kind of on the same mission with us. And I think part of that mission is like when people say, you know, like why, like you have to say why not, right? There's a little bit of like, it's okay. Let's figure it out. And one of the biggest things is really we're an interesting industry because we're very collaborative. And we also don't want to be, you know, when I say talk to people about innovation, nobody wants to be bleeding edge. And nobody wants to be left behind. And the number one thing they say is like, well, what's so-and-so doing? I mean, your competitor? Like, yeah, like our competitor, like, what are they doing? I'm like, well, they're doing X, Y, and Z. And they're like, well, I guess we're behind, or I guess we're doing better. But nobody wants to lead, right? So we actually go through this process. We call it our dial process, which is basically gauging the culture of innovation. So there's the nuts and bolts of innovation, but then the nuts and bolts of innovation, you can put all this stuff in place. It's quite meaningless if you don't have the culture part of it.
Okay.
And so I think the biggest changes we're driving is, one, we do have capital, which is great, right? We write big checks to startups and do things, and that's highly transformative, but money is not enough. Like, money is not enough. And so you really have to kind of create a movement around these things.
So when you think about that innovation, you know, one question that comes to my mind is when we think about innovating in the built environment, is most of the innovation coming from inside? Is it coming from in-house, or is it people that are outside of architecture, engineering, you know, the things that we would traditionally, the fields that we would traditionally think about in terms of shaping the built environment? Is it people from the outside looking and saying, oh, there's a hole, there's a problem I can solve? Is there a rhyme or reason or sort of a trend in where you see the innovation coming from?
Yeah. So I think what happens is most of the ideas in innovation come from, yet the ability to execute those ideas is nearly impossible on the end.
Okay.
So most of my founders, you know, I don't know, 30 or 40 of them now. We have a lot of founders. between our portfolio and our incubator, we have lots of founders. I don't think there's one of them that, hey, I was walking by a job site and I was wondering how they manage safety. Like that never happens, right? It was more, hey, I was a superintendent at XYZ Construction for 15 years. And I think it's really stupid the way we handle things and like left and started a startup around it. So we very rarely have people that, we have nobody without any industry experience. The challenge is that, you know, to keep it in the business, like there's a few companies like, you know, and I advise a lot of these companies, like Thornton Tomasetti started their own internal innovation thing several years ago, and I helped them launch that. And, you know, it was tough, right? Like you look around, it's like, are you billable? Mm. Like, no, I'm working on innovation. Which project is that for?
Yeah.
Right. So if all you can do is customer funded innovation, i.e. it has to fit in within the boundary condition of a project budget, you're not going to get any.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And I think that's, you know, I guess this is a broader topic because we were talking before we went live about other topics that we cover, and we get into when you get into fee structures or proposal structures, things like that. And this is not to throw anybody or their views under the bus, but you know, it seems to me that in an industry that is driven by timesheets, that is whether you're billing hourly, you're at least tracking hourly, I think, you know, that would seem to be a limiter on just about any sort of change. If you're only being rewarded by the number of hours that you're sitting at your desk, so to speak.
Yeah, I'll always say like my job is chasing asymmetry. Hmm. And part of asymmetry is that hour worked, hour paid is very symmetric.
Right.
I need to work an hour and get paid for 1,000 hours.
Okay.
And I'm okay if I waste an hour every hour I work does not have to bear fruit, but the ones I do work, I need to get 1,000x.
Okay.
And so that's my job, is to chase that asymmetry. And the challenge is when you think about services companies, as you scale up, they become a labor. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting. I was out with the CEO of a top five firm, and he said, like, KP, based on the innovation you've been working with us on, I think I could go start a 5-person firm and do $50 million in fees.
Okay.
Day one, because I don't know why we have all these accounting people. I don't know why we have all these marketing. Like, he's like, I just don't know why we have all these things. And then we have engineers that don't know how to use computers, right? Like what are we doing here? Right.
Yeah.
He's like, the problem is the end customer will, the first thing they'll ask is, well, how many people do you
have? How many people? Yep.
Right. So how do you change the behavior of the end customer, developer, owner, whatever, that says, do not judge me on my labor capacity, right? We just need to know that do you have the capacity for work?
Right.
Don't judge me on that. Judge me on the end product. And I think that, you know, and think about the deliverables we go through during the marketing process, project profiles. If you do government, what is it, the 254s and the 255?
Right.
Like, what does that all say? That says, I want referenceability of your projects, and I want to know about your people. So I'm basically labor arbitrage.
Right.
And when you see any labor arbitrage, it's just a really fast chase to the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So do you have any ideas on how to change that behavior on the end customer side?
Yeah, I think some of it comes through understanding risk, right? Like we don't like risk, right?
Right.
And there's a reason why contractors financially do a little bit better. Developers do even better than that. And it's a risk quotient.
Right.
But what is your risk tolerance? And it's quite funny, as an entrepreneur, people are like, oh my God, you take on so much risk. It's like, do I? Or do I just know how to take on risk and manage it well? Like I know what I'm doing. And so I think some of that is, how do you get out of your own way? You say we want to partner with the customer, but then we are a vendor.
Right.
Like I love asking developers, like, tell me about your vendors. What do you mean? Like our trash people? I'm like, no, you know, your architects, engineers, contractors. And they're like, you call them vendors? I'm like, well, what are they? How do you treat them?
Yeah.
How do you treat them? Well, I guess you're right. I treat them like vendors. I'm like, well, right. Why do you treat them like vendors? Because they behave like vendors. They don't ask me, like they don't know what the economics of my project are. They don't want to take any shared risk. And so that means, but the problem is when you take on shared risk, there has to be an upside. And I think that's where, back to the chasing asymmetry,
Right.
You might have a project, you lose money, but the projects that go well, they have to go really well.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting conversation, because now we're, in a way, we're discussing the value of an architect or an engineer, you know, whoever the vendor that doesn't want to be a vendor is, and it would change the dynamic of the economic exchange. We talked about that on Monday, I guess, in the context in Clarity Classroom, which is another aspect of what we do here. The importance of understanding the economics, developer or whoever the end user is, the client is, understanding the economics as being a key to the value that you can bring to the table as the designer or whatever role that you're playing there. Let me go a different direction. When you think about the spectrum of a project, you know, maybe from or the timeline of a project, maybe from concept to occupancy, there's a lot obviously that happens, designing and developing constructing and approvals and everything that happens over the course of these very complicated things, right? Where do you think the biggest holes or the biggest opportunities for innovation are? And it doesn't have to be linear, but thinking about it in those terms, where do you think the biggest opportunities for innovation are?
Well, so I tend to exclude, you know, you look at known knowns and known unknowns and unknown knowns, right? And yeah. Government is that unknown unknowns, right? So when people talk about automating permitting and AI and all this, I'm like, maybe, yeah. Right? Because at the end of the day, there's some government that isn't really your partner, right?
Right.
But I do think when it comes to collaboration and real-time collaboration and really this linear iteration we do to develop a project, you know, is kind of what I think is messed up the most, right? And I really believe words matter, right? Words matter. If I ask you, Jeff, you're working at an architecture firm, and okay. I say, how big is your firm? What's your answer?
100 people.
Right. So you define success by the number of people.
Okay.
That's your yep. That's your success quotient, right? Yep. If I ask a contractor, how big's your company?
Oh, 100 million.
Right. So that vocabulary starts to matter. And then when you think about, as an architect, what's your deliverable as an architect?
It's a set of a big stack of paper.
Right. And if I ask a contractor, what's your deliverable?
A building,
right? Yeah. And so there's like this natural misalignment around mission and goals and collaboration. And it's right there in front of us, right? It's right there in front of us. And so I think that's where you have to start thinking about, where does innovation, why can't the contractor be involved during the design process, right? Why do we do drawings? Like, why are we, it's like we're playing this game that says, oh, see if you can figure out my drawings, plans, and specs, and see how you interpret them, and then create shop drawings. And I'm going to tell you whether you got the right answer or not.
That's the way it works, isn't it?
Right. But it's like a game, right? It's like, yeah. You know, it's like a child, it's like a children's game. Like I'm going to mess with you, right?
Yeah.
But nope. Wrong answer. Try again. Right.
I hadn't looked at it that way.
I spy.
Yeah, it is that. So, So when you think about things like that, do you look out at other industries? You know, where are you observing? Where are you gaining, you know, your cues for this type of innovation?
Yeah. So it's interesting. You know, we do this annual summit and it's become like, it's our seventh year doing it. It's in October, I think, this year. But, you know, it's interesting. It's always bringing people from other industries, and it kind of like, it really helps people open their eyes to like what's going on. Cause I think you do have to look. The problem is, what other industry, like we want to compare ourselves to factories and things like that, which I think is the wrong idea, right? It's really the movie industry. That's where we are today, right? Because movies shape culture and humanity and all the things too, right? In a different way.
Right.
But everybody shows up to a project. Maybe they've worked together. Maybe they haven't worked together.
Mm-hmm.
And then they do some things together. And then they all leave. Mm-hmm. And they move on to the next project. Maybe there's an actor or a director you've worked with before that you like and you have rapport with, which we do the same thing. Right? We do the same thing. There's, if you're an architect, you work with certain MEP firms because you know the people. And so we look a lot more like the movie industry, but what you're seeing even in the movie industry is this shift to like, now you have Netflix and like the streaming stuff, right?
Right.
Is we're saying like, oh, we're going to build franchises together and we're going to go, you know, shape movements together. We're going to go do these things together, and we're going to do it over and over and over again, right? And so it's kind of like how the movie, you know, back in the day, they had the studio system. You were part of, you were paid by the studio, you were part of the studio.
Right.
We're kind of moving back to that a little bit in the movie industry. So I think there is best practices to learn from that, right? And clearly the creatives in the movie industry, they get paid.
Right.
They get paid. They get paid well.
That is a really interesting correlation. Had not thought about that before. So, you know, one of the things that I do with my grad students is we start out first day of class, and I say, you know, look around you, spend the next week looking around you, trying to identify problems that need to be solved. Leave it pretty broad at that point. Now, of course, you know, I guess if we're talking about innovating in the built environment, we could take that literally and go, okay, well, I don't know what the things are. You know, there's probably homelessness. There's probably, you know, how hard it is to find, well, that's already been done. I was going to say how hard it is to find a parking space and pay for a parking space, those types of things. But when you're talking about that movie industry, I could say, okay, you know, how do I draw more lines? You know, where do I see a hole over here? And is there a correlation to, you know, that, like you said, the studio structure or the financing structure or something like that? When you're, and I heard you talking with Mark about this as well, but when you're thinking about these problems that need to be solved, how do you prioritize them, or how do you say this is a good problem to solve? This is a problem that maybe needs to be solved, but.
So I just gave you context. Now I'll give you clarity. In the movie industry, there's clarity around who the customer is.
Yeah.
There's just absolute clarity. Who am I here to delight? Who am I here to influence? Like, who is that customer, right?
Yeah.
And we forget who our customer. If you're building, if you're designing a hospital, who is the customer?
It's going to be the person in the bed.
Right. And that's really what the owner needs help with. And for some reason, we get, you know, if you ask the contractor, ask the drywall person, right? Yeah. Who's your customer? The contractor.
Right.
No, it's the patient. Mm-hmm. Like, we're all working in a way to serve the customer, which may not be transactionally our firm.
Right.
Maybe it's more the user. And we all have to be aligned on what we think that user experience will be like today, tomorrow, and the next day, and how we want to craft and shape that user experience. And it takes kind of everybody being in the room, like the idea that nobody, you know, not everybody's voice matters, not everybody's opinion, you know, the drywall guy's opinion doesn't count. Like, I mean, maybe it doesn't, depends on the person.
Right.
Maybe it does.
I think that's a really interesting observation, because it is, you know, I wonder, all week we've been talking about, you know, problems that we see. We start out talking about design process and design technology, and then construction process and construction technology. And yesterday we talked about sort of that, the question I asked before about the whole process of design and construction. And one of the things that we have, identified is that we do have our little silos. And I don't remember how it came up, but one of the questions I asked in response to somebody's comment was, do we need to control more? Mm-hmm. You know, do we need to have more? You know, if it's the architect as developer, or, you know, some model, does there need to be more central control, or is that missing the point?
That's missing the point. Control is a fallacy.
Okay.
Control is a fallacy. So I mean, if you have kids, you know this. So yeah. Control. If you have teenage kids, you would definitely know this, right? Yeah. Control is a fallacy. Yeah. So I think, but that's part of how we need to start thinking, right? Like, how do we think about the instant? How do we think about, and how do we really, I mean, truly collaborate, right? Truly work together and understand, like, here's what this market needs, right? Here's what this user needs. I mean, we're seeing it right now with the office world. Right. Oh my gosh, what are we going to do with all these offices? What are we going back to the office? Like, well, if you turn on the news and we talk about return to office, who do they talk to? They talk to a real estate developer. They might talk to some epidemiologist about, like, safety, like, whatever. Haven't seen an architect on TV. Haven't seen an architect on TV and talking about the culture of, like, working from home. And, like, they're talking to everyone except the people that have to think about the next, right? Oh. And so I think at the end of the day, it's like, shaping these experiences. And I think in order to have a seat at the table and be collaborative, it is bringing that, you know, bringing that to fruition in terms of just really trying to say, okay, what do we envision this project as? And to your audience of you know, not being like the largest firms, the right. problem with the largest firms is they're going to do a terrible job. They start, right? They're building their system, right? Is how do we turn revenue into profits? How do we turn revenue into profits? And how do we optimize? The reality is technology is great at optimization. People are terrible at it. And it's not a good thing. It's not a good thing to always be optimized, right?
Yeah.
A lot of it, and unfortunately, large firms are always going to be, are going to suffer around, here's our system, our process. And so the ability to create and execute a new idea is very difficult.
Right. You mentioned the CEO a few minutes ago of a top five that said he could start a new firm. I think you said of five people and hit 50 million. How is he going to do that? Is it technology? What's his plan? Yeah. I'm guessing that's very, very different than the firm that he currently guides.
Yeah, because the firm he's at is all about timesheets and keeping people busy,
yeah.
right? This is about executing on the vision of what the customer needs and being compensated appropriately and leveraging lots of technology.
Yeah.
And reducing, you know, so if you think about process and technology, being there on the front end, it was kind of interesting. I remember advising a structural engineering firm, and I was asking them, how do they work with their architects? Like, and they're like, well, we wait till they make up their mind until we actually start doing work.
Okay.
And I'm like, okay. Like, so they're like, yeah, we just sit in on meetings and we let them talk about what they're doing and we don't go draw. Like, why would you go draw? They're going to change their mind. And I'm like, have you shared that with your architect? No. Why would I do that? And I'm like, this is absolutely fascinating. Like, everybody's trying to game the other person, right? And so I do think when it comes to innovation, is really picking apart things that make you more productive and leave more space, like for your kind of creativity. Like I've been, I wrote a book on BIM as well, textbook. It's very boring, but I think BIM kind of saved our industry, quite honestly. Like, if you had to tell someone coming into college, like your life is going to be doing door details and CAD. Like we would have lost the entire millennial generation.
But right.
Instead, we're like, oh no, you do 3D, right? They're like, you can get them excited, right? So, so we did save a generation with BIM, but like we just invested, you know, to talk about my book, but we just invested in a company called Spaces that is like sketching on an iPad, creating parametric, which seems like the opposite direction.
Hmm.
Right. Like, I'm like, no, you know, and one of the reasons we invest is like, no, we're back. Like, that's what people want. It's not like, oh, let me sketch something and hand it to the BIM person.
Right.
No, I want to sketch and draw and then it automatically go into BIM. I don't want this intermediary. So we look at that and, you know, we've been looking at some trends too, like, especially the supply chain taught us a lot. Mm-hmm. Supply chain issues taught us a lot. And so like a lot of our MEP engineering clients and investors, they were saying they're designing with product that was unavailable.
Right.
And they're like, well, how are we supposed to know? How are we supposed to know that? And so they're iterating around product availability. And it's like, well, when you're designing, why don't you know availability, right? Why don't you know that? Like, well, nobody tells us. It's not shared with us.
So when you think about something like the Spaces app, which is fascinating, and as you describe it, I'm thinking that's the way it ought to be, right? So and your job is basically to go out and identify these things, right? The Spaces app and the other innovations that are worthy of venture capital investment. But what's standing in the way? What are some of the biggest hurdles of innovation right now? Because when you talk about Spaces app, one thing that I would have to think is a roadblock is large, heavily invested tech companies, not to name any, but that are probably thinking, yeah, we don't want to see that take hold.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they are the problem, right? Autodesk is the problem. Procore is the problem. They're all the problem, right? I mean, you have to look at the math, right? I don't know what they charge, $7,000 or $9,000 a year for a license. They have you. All your legacy product is in their data set. What incentive do they have to invest more?
Right.
They're a publicly traded company. They have zero incentive to deliver more for the same price. Why would I deliver more for this? Have priced the product. They know what the pricing tolerance, because they do. They are very smart. It's not that they're dumb. They're very smart. They understand what the pricing tolerance is for an architect. And they play right up to that and deliver as little as possible at that price point. It's a business model.
Yeah.
But that's not just our industry. If you look at any industry, you end up with these incumbent software providers that get very comfortable and they stifle innovation. If you look in the 90s, we had Microsoft, right? Microsoft, like, oh, everything was Microsoft. Can't get around Microsoft. Now we have options.
Right.
What has it done? It's kind of fascinating how Microsoft was the most stodgy, old, terrible technology. And then now look at that. Right. As soon as the FTC stepped in and said, hey, you can't own the browser market, things changed. Right. It opened it up for everyone else. So I think I think that is a big part of the problem. And I think it's also just like we talk about taking risks, that back in the day, there was a saying, nobody ever got fired for hiring IBM kind of thing.
Right. Yep.
Nobody gets fired for buying Autodesk's next crappy product.
So when you're out, and I know you have people approaching you all the time, I know you're out there scouting. You're talking to a lot of people. When you're out looking for the next investment, if I can say it that way, mm-hmm. what are you looking for? I mean, what is it that piques your interest and says this might be something that starts the process here?
Yeah. So big markets, right? So big markets matter. You can't have like niche plays. I always ask a question of like, how big is the market? If you win the market, how much revenue can you drive? And then two, if you win, who loses? Mm-hmm. We are in a game of winning and losing, unfortunately. That is how that works, right?
Yeah.
And so if they tell me if I win, Procore loses, you got my interest. If I win, Autodesk loses, you got my interest. If you tell me like, no, we're just going to play well with everyone, I'm like, that sounds like 5-year-old T-ball. I'm not that interested. So everybody doesn't get a medal, right? And then anything, part of the thing that we're pretty fortunate about is because we have such a great strategic partner community, right? Culture doesn't scare us. Like, so when we see a startup and they say, and maybe another investor looks at it and is like, well, culturally, they'll never go for that, right? I get the benefit of picking up the phone and talking to all my investors and their employees and saying like, is that true? And like, yeah, that's true, but you could change my mind. So if you look at it in our community of companies, that's about 25,000 design professionals.
Mm.
So if they say, hey, we'll change our mind, we'll change how we think about this process because it is better and we like this technology, I can change their mind, or at least their bosses. We are doing this.
Sure, yeah.
We are standardizing on that.
Yeah, it gets passed down to them. Yeah.
And that creates enough momentum, right? So the culture piece, this is a huge cultural change, doesn't it? And then anything that actually, I would say, has great impact to the environment in India. Like that, we think that's really important. I think carbon credits are a scam, in my opinion. I think there's a lot of things that are scams out there in the vein of environmentalism. I remember being at a conference where somebody got a green building award because they used recycled concrete. And then come to find out the recycled concrete was from where they poured a slab in the wrong place on the same project. It's like, so you screwed up and got an award. Fantastic. Yeah, nice. Like, fantastic. And if you look at kind of the waste in construction, if you say 20% of a project ends up in the dumpster, cut it in half and everybody gets a free house.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. What do you see that excites you?
Seeing a lot around, I would say, getting tools, whether it's software, automation or whatever, throughout the entire supply. Right. So we can sit here as designers and engineers and architects, sit in our computer and collaborate. But that person swinging the hammer, like, how are we connecting? Right. They're so far removed. Right.
Right.
And so we're starting to see some really interesting technology that combines like IoT and computer vision. One of our companies, Aaron, basically you can fly a drone. It can take a bridge, a building, whatever, turn it into a 3D model automatically. Identify all the cracks, run engineering analysis, and predict when maintenance needs to happen, either on a facade or a bridge or a pavement or within 15 minutes.
Wow. Is this coming out soon? Already out.
So here's the interesting thing. Why isn't it being more adopted? Unfortunately, like you have you know, it's either we have to sell to DOTs or to governments, or we have to sell to owners. And they say, well, my engineering firm. So then we get an engineering firm. It's like, well, how am I going to make money on your technology? Like, I bill hours.
Right.
So like, how about a different model?
Right. Yeah.
Right. And if you know, like in technology, we talk about SaaS revenue. So the recurring model. What if you owned the maintenance of the facade? Like you were like cybersecurity monitoring. You were facade monitor, and you use our technology. You charge them an annual fee, and you're not filling out timesheets. Yeah. And they're like, "Oh, we don't know how to like. How do we even do that? I mean, we send an invoice out every year, and we don't do work." And I'm like, "Yes, like, but are we allowed to do that? Like, is that ethical?" And I'm like, "What are you doing? Like, how do I put that on my timesheet?"
those constructs are really interesting, right? It's fascinating where they've come from and how they've taken hold and how they control so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've had to teach them how to build new business models.
So when someone, an architect, let's say, has an idea, they identify a problem, they have an idea, whatever process they're going through, what's the process of getting to you or any venture fund, but what's the process of developing that idea into an innovation?
Yeah, we're very different. So I don't like to talk about others, but I'm a big fan of meritocracy.
Okay.
So every deal we look at comes in.
Okay.
I personally review every deal that comes in through the website every morning, and then I approve, reject, whatever, with a reason. And if I approve, then they automatically get set up with the meeting. So even if another VC or a CEO of an architecture firm's like, "Hey, I got this great startup we're looking at," I'm like, "Great, send them to the website." Everybody comes in through the front door. There are no back doors. And so it drives an interesting culture. People don't want to hear about that. But sometimes people are like, "No, but I know KP, I can get you a meeting." And my response is like, fill out this form on the website. They're like, "What's the point of a relationship?" I'm like, "Exactly, like meritocracy." But we have this one company in India. He loves telling the story. He's like, "I went onto the website, I filled out the form. A week later, I was on a call with KP and his CTO. And 30 days later, I got funded. I didn't know anybody. I just went onto the website."
Yeah, yeah.
And we've had that happen twice now. So, so yeah, it's pretty simple in terms of how we interact. That is not how most venture companies,
right?
Quite honestly,
right?
It's definitely like a, do you know somebody?
So if you've got an idea and you want to submit it via the website, the URL is in the bottom left hand corner right now, shadow.vc. So bring your best ideas, and KP will review them. And that is fascinating. That is your process. How many do you review? How many, you know, like on a weekly basis or monthly, whatever?
Weekly, anywhere from 30 to 50. Interview, okay. 12 to 20 a week.
Okay. All right. And how many, any rough guess as to how many eventually go through and get funded?
Yeah. On average, we make 1 to 2 investments a month.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's definitely tough. You know, there's a couple things that, and it's really hard to explain to people because they just don't want to hear it. You know, first of all, I start with, you know, Shark Tank is a show. It's not real. It's zero real.
Zero? Really? Yeah. Zero real?
So it's a show. And the thing that people have to understand is venture capital is downhill skiing. A lot of investors do cross-country skiing. It's still both skiing. But it's very different. So when I invest a dollar, I'm trying to get 100 back.
Right.
I'm trying to get 1,000 back. Right. So my bar is very high. So it has to be big market, very disruptive, very difficult. But that doesn't mean that other businesses are not good business. It just means that they're not going to scale. Right.
Yeah.
If I said, "Hey, Jeff, you know, here's a $5 million euro business that generates $2 million in profit. You want to buy it?" You'd be like, "Yeah, fantastic." I would say no. Mm-hmm. Right. I would say no, because my track record is to deliver 30x and 50x on a dollar invested.
Yeah.
And something that does 5% a year and generates a couple million in profit, that's not my game. That's cross country skiing. Uh-huh. And it's fine. It's highly predictable and manageable. But that doesn't make it a bad business. So a lot of times the argument turns into like, "But it's a great business." I'm like, "It's a great business, but it's not a venture fundable."
Right.
Go ask 3 friends to give you some money and go build a nice business that generates. There's probably very few people that would turn down a $2 million year revenue business that generates $500,000 in profit.
Yeah.
It's a nice business. just not my kind of business.
That's an important point. And I suspect there are a lot of people that don't understand that dynamic, right? It is investment. It is high stakes and big multiples, which again, I think we touched on this in the beginning. I know you touched on it in your conversation with Mark, you know, the idea of investing in a professional services firm, let's say, doesn't work, one, because of the labor arbitrage, right?
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't scale. It's hiring more people, right? That's the scale factor. So I think that's a big part of it. It's based on profitability. It doesn't scale, you know, that kind of. And so, you know, if I went to an architecture firm, if I gave you $100 million in business and needs to get done in the next 90 days, how are you going to do it? Like, oh, I got to hire more people, right?
Yeah.
In technology, that's not the case. It's like, yeah, right. Just spin up more servers.
Arturo wants to know if there's anything in the works for virtual reality, BIM, and 5D modeling.
There's actually a lot out there. There's a lot out there already. The challenge really is kind of the adoption of it. You know, the question is, just because you can, should you?
That's a good point. You know?
And so there's, you know, we get really excited. You know, we're talking about it before, like how I'd worked for Frank Gehry, and those are a different level of project.
Right.
The majority of our world, middle school, fire station, I mean, that's the core. And like when people talk about BIM adoption, like, oh, BIM adoption, it's like still not using it on a K-12 school. Like, I mean, it's just not like, so when you look at the mass market of our industry, some of these tools are just, they are overkill, but there is a lot out there. There's a lot already out there. We have a company called Altura that does no-code VR, AR experiences. So as an architect, you don't even have to know how Unity works and all these different software packages. You just plug and play and go. So I think the other thing we've done, you know, earlier this year, we split up Shadow Ventures and Shadow Partners. And Shadow Ventures is purely about investing. And Shadow Partners is really about collaboration and community. I had the CEO of a very large general contractor tell me, like, hey, what you're doing is special and important, because a lot of people think it's throw money at the problem. Mm. And you're kind of saying, nope, I'm going to throw money at the problem, but I'm also going to build a community that cares about the problem, that is like signed off on, like, I'm in this with you, and I will take risks and I will work with you. You know, so it's been really interesting, the community building. And I know you build a community, but it's really building this community that's very mission oriented and very collaborative, that wants to take risks and chances and learn about new ideas and models. And so it's been pretty fantastic.
You keep coming back to that word collaboration, which is obviously an important word. When we think about the future, maybe we frame this around our audience and say the future of small firm architects, entrepreneurial architects. What's the most important thing for, you know, somebody that's, so maybe it's a one person firm, maybe it's a 10 person firm, but what's the most important thing looking out into the future and these things that you're talking about? What do they need to be thinking about and doing in order to maybe push a more innovative future or maybe more secure future for that matter? Because I think there's, you know, there are assaults from other industries and providers. So what should small firm architects be doing and thinking about?
I think it really comes down to being a specialist in understanding the user. Because the thing that's really changed, I mean, if you take like registration requirements to aside, being registered in every state and every country and all that stuff, like let's take that aside for a second. If you really understand what a patient wants in a hospital and their outcomes and their experience, and you become the best at that, and that's all you're, and you have to be passionate. Like, this is what I care about, right?
Yeah.
This is all I care about. I don't care about working on middle schools and fire stations. This is all I care about. We live in a world where you have the ability to be the best, to be the number one person. And it might be as a consultant. It might be as an architect. Like, maybe, oh, they want to do a big hospital in Dubai and I'm not registered there or whatever. So what? If you have an opportunity to be passionate and narrow focused in this world and make a great living, right? Make a great living because you're the best, right? The minute you're not a category of one, you're a category of many, it's being competitive, right? And so I think I do a lot of like this kind of coaching for people And I'm a huge Venn diagram person. I keep making them draw Venn diagrams, right? And so part of it is like, you know, when you draw the Venn diagram, that intersection, that's where you can charge the most. That's where you see asymmetry, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. So if I just want to hire an architect that can do anything, then I can put an RFP out.
Right.
Right. And get bids.
Yep.
And get proposals. But if I say, I need an architect that understands the user experience of a patient in a surgical center in the Middle East, and you're the only one that fits that, then you charge whatever you want to charge.
Yeah.
A massive asymmetry.
I love that. And it, you know, at some point, we've not only got to develop that, right? We've got to have that passion. We've got to develop that expertise, you know, all of those things. But then we've got to be able to communicate that, which I think, you know, we often fall short on that front, I think, in this industry as well.
Yeah, I think we get a little fixated on IP.
Mm.
Oh, that's my IP.
Yeah.
Like that 5-story medical office building plans, those are that's your IP. Is that what you're really saying? Like, that's not your IP. Like, it's not that big a deal. Like, give it away. Like, who cares? Right. And I think when it comes to content and sharing information and expertise, there's a little bit of like, well, hire me first. It's like, well, no, that's your marketing. And
right.
I don't think anyone's going to steal your, if they steal your idea, great. So what? Right.
Yeah.
But when we talk about in technology, you know, Google was not the first, Facebook was not the first, you know, ideas have a life of their own and you just want to be in the mix.
Those are excellent points. I mean, I think that's one thing that we overlook all the time. You know, the first to the market is rarely the one that we remember as being the winner, so to speak, in that market or in that sector. A few weeks ago, we talked with Marcus Sheridan. I don't know if you're familiar with Marcus, but he wrote a book called They Ask, You Answer. And he would have that same point of view. It's you just put the ideas out there. He's basing it on questions that your customers or clients ask, but you just put the information out there. And one of the things that he says a lot is, who's going to steal it, right? Most people are not stealing it. Most people are not putting in the work, you know, and even if they do, you're still two or three steps ahead of them.
Yeah.
You know, looking back, you're leading and they're following.
And I think there's like, I had the benefit on my, I took like a 2-year sabbatical. And on that sabbatical, I'd have people like, hey, can you do some consulting? I don't want to do timesheets. I don't want to do deliverables. Like, do you still want me to help? and I basically made it really simple. I said, send me a problem statement.
Mm.
Send me a problem statement and I'll go solve that problem. And if I solve that problem, you pay me whatever you think. That was my entire model. I didn't have an SOW. There were no SOWs. There were no PowerPoints.
Yeah.
There wasn't even really a contract. It was all like via text and email. And I did like 5 or 6 projects and there was massive asymmetry financial.
Interesting.
Okay. So can you give me an example? What would someone say their problem statement was that then you would solve? And then how much did they give you? Because you know what? This kind of reminds me of the no cost lemonade. That my kids would always do a lemonade stand on Nantucket that it was free. But if you wanted to donate something, whatever you felt like it was worth, you should. And they made a ton of money. There was, what do you call it? When you get paid a lot more
asymmetry.
Than you think asymmetry. You would. The asymmetry was huge in that lemonade stand. So what is the kind of problem statement that you would get? I'm just trying to imagine that.
I got one where a board said, hey, I think my CEO is caustic, but not violating any of his contractual requirements, but we think he's a bad egg and he's got a 3-year contract and we're not sure what to do. Can you help us transition him out?
Oh, interesting.
Wow.
So the board hired me to be a executive coach for him. Okay. And I sat down with him and said, man, you are fantastic. It's like, they just don't value you here is the problem. They don't get you.
Oh my,
you need to be in an organization that values you and gets you. And you should really think about that.
Does he know that you did that? Because he'll know now after he listens to our podcast.
He's very happy. So he ended up leaving.
Is he on
bet? I gave him some ideas on careers to pursue and gave him some introductions. And he's happy. His current employer is happy. And he resigned.
Wow.
So you tell me a CEO that's making, call it $1 million a year, 3-year contract, plus litigation, plus all those things.
Yeah. Nice.
So what was that, like one day of meetings and a couple conversations?
Yeah.
And they kicked me $250.
Did you have to buy a new outfit for it or anything? I mean, you go like in, as yourself?
That's myself.
This is an undercover boss.
No.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing is like, it's a weird thing in consulting when you, you know, so look, I did that little bit of work. I don't know how many hours I put into it, very little. And they paid me $250,000, right? Nice. So asymmetry. But, you know, when you look at that stuff, I mean, I was able to do that because I didn't like need the money. I had planned on a 2-year sabbatical and had all my bills paid for those 2 years. So it was like extra money. So, but as a firm, how do you get your head around? Like, I'm going to go do work on the come, or, you know, help me solve this problem statement. And if, you know, like that's tough when you have mm-hmm. a system of timesheets and margin and payroll and all those things. But mm-hmm. so much of, and I'm sure there's a lot of people that probably relate to this, how much of your energy is being put to just keep people busy?
Yeah.
Like to go win. I mean, there's so many times, I mean, and that's why I did this during my sabbatical. I was like, I've managed thousands of people and I felt like my entire job was to keep them fed. And when it was all said and done, there was like a couple of cashew nuts left over for me and they've been all eating steak, right?
Yeah.
So, so I think everybody gets into that mode of like, oh, I got all these people, I got to keep them busy. We just need to win that project because I have this team that's not busy, you know? So you get into that mindset of like, just trying to keep people busy and keep that engine going instead of thinking about like, well, maybe if I do less work and charge more because I'm highly specialized and take some risks on an outcome, maybe it works out. So it's one, it's like, it takes a level of courage and a little bit of like foresight and critical thinking to get there, right? But it's not trivial.
Right.
I was just in a spot where I could get away with it. Like I wasn't going to not pay my mortgage or not pay, make my payroll.
Right.
And there's a real question around that, right? Like when you're running a firm, like, am I better off just like being on my own doing, you know, doing less work at a higher dollar than, or keep all these people busy?
Those are important questions. And I love the, you know, focusing on that example sort of to wrap this up. I'd love to keep the conversation going, but we're already past our time. So we've got to be respectful to everybody. So hopefully, you know, hopefully as you're listening to this, either in the recorded version or you're with us here live, you get a little bit of encouragement, find a little bit of aspiration in what KP was talking about there. There are different ways to view the business of architecture. Arturo says problem statement. Exactly. Just collect problem statements. I love it. KP, thank you very much for this conversation. It's been fascinating. And we had a couple of comments earlier about how they love the conversation. So thank you very much for that. Appreciate you.
All right, thanks, y'all.
Well, what do you think? Did you hear something in this conversation that you can use, maybe in your practice or even in your life? If the topic of this conversation is of particular interest to you, every week in the Entree Architect Network, I host the Context and Clarity Classroom. It's our weekly opportunity to take what we've learned from our special guests and put those lessons into action in your life and in your work. Find the Context and Clarity Classroom exclusively inside the Entree Architect Network at network.entrearchitect.com. And if you are so inspired by this conversation that you'd like to watch the entire Context and Clarity Live episode, head on over to YouTube. Find the Entree Architect YouTube channel. There's a playlist there that has all of the full Context and Clarity Live episodes. You can also have the Context and Clarity podcast delivered to you every week. Just give us a rating and subscribe wherever you're listening right now. Your likes and your ratings and your shares all help us help other entrepreneur architects like you. And together, they help us build the largest worldwide community of small firm architects. And if you love content like this, check out Gable Media. It's a multimedia network for people that care about the built environment. And it's the home of Context and Clarity. With Gable's growing family of podcasts and video channels, I know that you're going to find something there that interests you. You can learn more at GableMedia.com. That's GableMedia.com. So thanks for listening. I hope this conversation has inspired you to think about how you can build your business into something that allows you to practice the way that you want to practice.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.